Okay, we're here at Dirt Time 2011, and it's actually July already. I'm here with Jason Deatherage from Canada and the illustrious Paul Campbell from La Crescenta. Are you going to join us, Paul?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? And Fig Nubla. And we're going to talk about some of the literature and movies that have end of the world or cataclysmic scenarios in them. And do you have a favorite one, Jason?
As a longtime connoisseur, I prefer the ones that are plausible.
Okay.
And or if they're not plausible, they don't go to great lengths to explain what happened, so you can fill it in. I was a real big fan of The Road because there was no names given, no one sentence description of perhaps what the disaster might have been. But
did you see the book? I read the book as well as see the movie.
Yes, I read the book first and then saw the movie.
Yeah, I thought The Road was a very dark kind of a movie, and in a sense, I have to agree with you. It seemed more believable because you didn't know what was going on.
Well, and you know, everyone always assumes, you know, if the world ends, that somehow they'll be left unscathed with all their supplies, and you know, they'll just go out and garden and, you know,
and nobody would
water.
Bother them.
Like, how did everyone else die if all those things are feasible? You know what I mean? The road was kind of nice in that sense because, I mean, you know, the country was stripped bare and there's just nothing to eat. And
in the book, did it give more clues as to what actually happened to civilization or the city?
It gave far less, in fact. The movie was far more expository about, you know, the relationship with the mother and all of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the book, it was really, you know, there's the father and son didn't call themselves even by name, you know, and the mother was referred to only in the fact that she had, you know, you got some sort of hint that she had killed herself sometime.
I see.
But there was no scenes with the mother. There was none of that family stuff that was in the movie, you know, where they're playing the piano and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. What I remember about it is that there something had happened. There were kind of gangs were the rule of the day, different groups and gangs, and then there was some suggestion at cannibalism.
Yeah, that was the main thing. I think, you know, everything had been stripped bare. It was getting colder. Nothing was growing. There was no animals. So it wasn't so much gangs as just people that had pulled together and were actually trying to survive by eating people. That seemed to be the main...
It's kind of what I call a gang.
Yeah. I mean, but not criminal enterprise. It was like bare survival.
Well, just surviving, right.
Yeah.
Did you see The Road, Fig?
No, I haven't seen The Road.
You hadn't read it either?
No.
I am shocked, because you're such a connoisseur of all literature.
I was starting to, and then I thought, someone told me it was really depressing.
It is depressing.
It's the bleakest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. I didn't continue then.
Is there a book that you particularly like? Or
I like the Deathlands series.
The Deathlands, tell us about it.
Oh, it's a setting where the whole world was destroyed by this nuclear war, and people had to survive. They have redoubts, they have matter transport units, they have mutants, cannibals, a lot of different, they call guns blasters, and there's all sorts of things happening. It's like a serial.
It's about 50 books or so, the Deathlands?
50 books for Deathlands, and they had the offshoot series, Outlanders and Survivalists, and they're really good too, in the same genre, you know, for entertainment. It's a very good value.
And available on audiobook too,
On long drives. I actually went through the whole thing in the audio format. I haven't really read the written version of it. You know.
Well, the value of such books to me, really, I mean, besides entertainment, is I'm saying, where are we going in our society? Could this happen to us? And what might I do about it? And in that sense, what did you say? What could you say you gleaned from the Deathlands books?
Well, the vocabulary they use, the expressions they had.
Yeah, some good expletives. Like,
yeah, expletives.
Fire blast.
By the three Kennedys.
Yeah, Gaia, preserve us.
Gaia, help us. Yeah. You know, those things are all part of the parlance.
In other words, a new culture had developed in this post-cataclysmic world. Is
that what you're
saying?
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, the entertainment value, especially on long drives, you know, they really work the playing, you know.
Okay, so I haven't read those myself.
Simple
I think
concept.
I read one of those.
Yeah, very simple concepts, simple storylines. Almost non-existent storylines, but lots of gun porn and, you know.
That's what it's about, huh?
Yeah, and lots of bloody action.
What I remember in the one that I read...
Too, descriptive love scenes, yeah.
Yeah, it is a very adult... I mean,
adult book, yeah.
Yeah.
The one that I read, it seemed to emphasize that now that the trivialities of life are pretty much gone, you've got your vehicle to maintain and your firearm to maintain.
But you see, that's what end-of-the-world fiction is all about, right? It's a longing to escape the complexities of today. I mean, you got a lot of social complexities. You have to worry about earning money. You have to you have this life that you have to keep structured, you know, in the context of a large and uncaring society. I think deep down, a lot of the people that are into this or that write it, you know, they long for, you know, the simplicity of staying alive by, you know, your wit and your skills, and there's nothing to worry about except whether you have ammo and food, and, you know, they think somehow that'll be a simpler, more enjoyable, meaningful life, which I think it might be surprising to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's kind of like those who, like, long back to the way the Indians were, when, in fact, if they really studied it, it would be a rough life.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be terribly pleasant. I mean, there's a reason that civilization has chosen
evolved.
To advance itself, you know, to pursue comfort. I mean, especially in our society, I think, you know, we see consumerism and all that kind of stuff, and we'd love to see it wiped clean somehow, but I think that would be a more difficult thing.
Yeah, because what is the mechanism for that to happen, and what's actually going to happen to your life if
yeah,
that happens?
Yeah, and what makes you think you would survive, you know, when you're talking about wiping out 99% of the human race?
Yeah, I mean, what makes you
the
think
chances
you would survive?
Are
yeah.
heavily against you, no matter where you are.
So the thing that I always look at is, how is it possible here and now to preserve what we do think is good in culture and in civilization, and to eliminate or sort of avoid the bad parts? That's always the trick, because not everybody's interested in eliminate what you think is the bad.
Well, I mean, the conclusion I've come to is that all you can do is live the example. You know, choose to live that way yourself, and you can't do anything about other people.
That's true, you really can't.
You know, and I mean, society does impinge on you. It does have demands and things that you got to take care of, but you really can choose to live, you know, a simpler life if you really want to, but you just have to be able to deal with temptation.
Yeah.
You know,
like a lot of the folks that come here, they have normal lives and jobs, but the Gregersons over there, they're actually homesteading, and they're away, they're mm-hmm. off the grid, they're making their own food, growing
they're
their
already
food.
In that land.
yeah, they're already in that world. That's
they're
correct.
Much more death lands than us.
Right. Hey, Jose, how you doing? We're talking about books and movies about end-of-the-world scenarios, and...
Do you have a favorite?
I like Book of Eli.
Oh,
Book of Eli. Yeah. Did you guys all see it?
Yes.
I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I quite like that one.
Yeah, what about you, Sig?
It was enjoyable, and I thought it was pretty realistic looking.
It was realistic in a way. Denzel was great in there. I thought that if you really were in that scenario, it would be far worse than that movie portrayed it. Don't you think?
Most likely.
I mean, you had a land that we presume was pocked with nuclear blasts, right? There was nothing around, nothing alive.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, where does the food come from? All of that kind of thing. You know, it's a more complex life than I think people imagine it to be.
And so the whole social thing that we take for granted was redeveloped based on who has the resources. I thought it was interesting, so sort of a comment on today's society, that, you know, the whole Book of Eli was about Denzel wanted to get that Bible to somewhere on the West Coast. He had this inner vision to do that. And the other, whoever that bad guy was who wanted it, he knew that he could control people if he had that Bible, that book. Which, you know, what was he trying to say there? Like, there are people today who sort of use the mask of religion to control their people and dominate people and extract their money.
For sure.
You know?
True. Yeah, tools of social engineering. Yeah. I mean, on a positive note, I think, you know, if, quote-unquote, the world ended, you know, there'd be rough pockets, certainly, but I think generally people are more sensible than to collapse into man against man anarchy everywhere on the road.
I'd like to think people are more sensible.
I think generally communities would coalesce, and some might be tyrannical dictatorships, and some may be, you know, warlords, but at the same time, I think there'd be a lot of like-minded people that would stick together and have sensible communities, you know, that would sustain themselves.
I would assume that. I mean, I think the initial shock of no
lawlessness.
Yeah, there would be lawlessness if there was some breakdown or collapse of society as we know it.
Of course.
But then people would figure out how to that it's in your self-interest to work together and to cooperate.
And I mean, that's just the way human civilization functions. You know, we work as groups. We're not rugged individualists, man against nature. You know, man against man. We operate well in groups. You know, we have to teach each other things. We have to, you know, have companionship. All those things are as important as eating and drinking in some ways, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe not in the short term, but...
Yeah, just like this week, all the things that we learned, it would take us a lot longer to have figured it out on our own.
And I mean, if if there had been a nuclear war while we were all here, we wouldn't all turn on each other like vicious dogs and kill each other.
I certainly hope not.
No, I mean, we would, you know, we would all work together. I mean, these are all sensible people, despite a very diverse set of political and religious beliefs here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were capable of being generous with each other and all of those things. Those are things that matter at the end of the world, for
sure.
Yeah, and then when people specialize, it gives them more time to perfect their craft as opposed to trying to generalize and focus entirely on trying to do everything. You won't have enough time.
That's totally impractical.
And if we have a sensible group of, you know, at least semi-specialists, then we can come together and become bigger than we are, you know, in terms of numbers. You know, we can become a powerful group because we have people that know how to do lots of different things.
Do you guys have another favorite book or movie along these lines? To
Long Road Home was really good. That was a post-nuclear thing about some guys fleeing from the Chesapeake Bay on the eve of a nuclear war on a sailboat, you know, and their adventures sailing down. They were going to try and make it to South America for some reason. I can't remember the exact reason.
How did they know a nuclear something was going to happen?
Oh, they were like, there was bombs falling.
Oh, there were.
Yeah,
okay.
and they escaped as it happened, basically.
Did either of you guys read that one?
No, I didn't, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I've heard of that one, but I've not read it
either.
Last
name of the author was Reinhardt, Luke Reinhardt.
What did you get of a practical nature from that book?
Well, again, the book ends with them sharing a single can of corned beef with like a dozen people on the Horn of South America. You know, and it was an open-ended but bleak ending in a sense.
With how many people sharing it?
Like a dozen people or more, you know.
So that's the a new age version of the loaves and fishes.
Well, basically,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, you have a little bit and you work together and you have a lot to feed everybody.
It was a challenging book in a sense because, you know, other people ended up getting on the boat and they had to kind of let them stay. And, you know, it was that kind of difficult social thing going on, you know.
Now, did you guys all read
Lucifer's Hammer?
Lucifer's Hammer?
Yeah,
that was really good.
Yeah. And it was set in the Los Angeles area.
Right, so if you live in Southern California, you going to take off, Frederick?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, say goodbye to everybody.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Frederick leaving Dirt Time. All right. So Lucifer's Hammer is about, for those of you who don't know, it's a comet that hits the Earth. Hi, Corey. You leaving? We're talking about Lucifer's Hammer. So,
I want to get a picture with Dave.
Okay, I'm gonna pause.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're back with Lucifer's Hammer. And what were you saying, Jason?
I was just saying Lucifer's Hammer was a neat one because they didn't know that if the comet was going to hit. I mean, everyone pretty much thought it was going to miss. So no one really could prepare for it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, if you lived in Southern California, all the streets are familiar. And there were major earthquakes.
And the amount of flooding, that was really concerning.
There was flooding. There were tidal waves. And what I remember is that the small groups that got together, they formed their own political system. They had maps of the area, and they dived into the shops to get tools and things that they needed to make things.
That was significant, diving for pharmacy.
Well, yeah, for drugs, for tools, locksmithing shops, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, that's the other thing about modern times, too. I mean, I always think of these things psychologically, you know? I mean, we live surrounded by this society which tempts us with these things that we should want, you know. In the end of the world scenario, it's all free now, you know. It's all there for the gathering.
In a sense,
yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
And I think a lot of people have that sort of romantic fantasy of being able to go down to the gun store and pick out whatever they want without having to worry about it, you know. And
well, in fact, in this version, when L.A. Basin was underwater, they did do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they had to deal with rust and they needed guns.
But you look at any zombie movie or anything, it always involves, you know, heading down to the mall and everything you could want is there.
It's almost like pornography.
It is,
you know,
yeah.
Where it's this fantasy fulfillment.
It's like the beautiful
and family shows, Ed.
That's how families are made.
Okay, right, yeah. And, I've heard that before.
I mean, almost all of this post-apocalyptic, you know, fiction that you'll read, there is this element of fantasy, of fulfillment, of being able to get those things that we weren't able to attain just for the taking, you know. So a lot of these, you know, it's not just guns and tools, but a lot of these stories will talk about going to the coin dealers and getting the gold and silver.
And cars.
And, right. Thinking that they can use those for, you know, monetary uses later on. So all of a sudden, you know, relatively poor person, because he's got a little bit of smarts and a little bit of initiative, becomes very rich.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this fiction is about turning the tables socially, where maybe the outcast who was looked down upon because of his weird tendencies is now, you know, the king because he, you know, thought ahead a little bit, and he's no longer a pariah. He's you know, looked on with favor because he actually had the foresight to plan for some of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, what I like in a good novel is that the person who wrote it really seriously thought through what actually might happen.
Now, yeah, world building. Yeah.
And did you guys read? I think it's Earth Abides, because it's sort of what Zen is talking about.
Yeah.
Where we don't really know. Is it Earth Abides? There was a virus or something.
That's right. And he'd been bitten by a snake, so he was immune to it. But
okay.
Yeah.
And all the stores had all the stuff.
Exactly. And even that's the only problem I had with that book was probably 15 or 20 years down the line, they're still eating canned food.
Right.
Out of the stores,
that was questionable.
Yeah.
But what did they? The next generation in Earth Abides, remember they found money in the cash registers, the coins?
Yeah.
What did they do with them? Do you guys remember?
Well, I remember it had no meaning for them.
It had no meaning. They had these little round things with people's faces on them.
Yeah, it's a curiosity.
No, it wasn't jewelry. They pounded. They found that the dimes, the pennies, the nickels could be pounded for arrowheads.
Right, yeah.
And they used some for rabbits and some for bigger game.
And that's another theme that runs through a lot of these, like dyes the fire... covers a couple of generations, and you know how the next generation, everything that we've built that we've considered ourselves superior in the universe for, is meaningless to our children that you know came about after the disaster. You know,
in Earth Abides, for example, everybody was an archer. That's how you got your food.
Right. Yeah.
So archery was common. Did you read Earth Abides, Sig?
Yeah.
Did you read Earth Abides?
I have not. There's if you're interested in free fiction on this genre, Frugal Squirrels Forum has a section devoted to this, and
frugalsquirrels.com.
Yeah, and it runs the gamut from really good stories like Lights Out to a lot of mediocre stuff to, you know, outright crap that's unreadable.
Lights Out is a novel?
Yes.
What's it about?
It's about an EMP, and all of a sudden nothing's functioning. And these two guys actually that work together get their housing community on board, as it were, and they immediately go into survival mode, and you know, they have to they set up their housing community to be safe, you know, so they have patrols, they do training, they do gardening, of course they go out and gather whatever they can as quickly as they can before it goes. Very well written. It was free for a long time, and now it's actually published in paperback. But the good thing about this is it really explores a lot of these things, so you can think about them now and kind of have an idea of what you're going to do when it actually, if it actually happens. Now, I don't care where you live, at some point in time you're going to have a localized problem.
Right.
And it may only last a week or two or a couple of months.
It doesn't have to be the quote end of the world.
Right. No.
Like, let's say if you were in Japan after they had that...
That was the end of the world for a lot of people.
That was the end of the world for them. Yeah. Or in Hiroshima.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, that was their end of the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like, you know, ethical issues, like, you know, all right, you've, you know, stocked away, you know, 6 months or a year's worth of food, and your neighbors haven't, and they come to your house, or your friends haven't, and they come to your house. What do you do? Do you, you know, turn them away, or do you sacrifice your own ability to survive to take care of them? And in some cases, you may want to, because there's only so much you can do by yourself, you know, and if you can get a group together, and maybe they haven't prepared, but they bring certain skills to the table, it may be worth your while to support them for a while, because, you know, there's, you know, many hands make light work, and the work's going to be hard. So.
Well, that's interesting that in a lot of the survival scenarios you have the outsiders and the insiders. And I think in reality there is there are a lot of resources. So like you were saying, Zen, if people are all working together, my feeling is that always you'd have a better survival.
More of what you have, in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. But when you think about a lot of another sort of darker theme that runs under a lot of this is a very us versus them thing, you know, and in these books a lot of these characters have a chance to punish you know, the elements of society that they haven't agreed with, or have, you know, have, you know, oppressed them in however they feel they've been oppressed, you know.
Didn't you get two classes that developed in Lucifer's Hammer? Wasn't there like these two, there was a cannibalistic group,
yeah,
and then regular people?
Yeah, you know, so it's, there's always, you can find those lines drawn in our society too, you know, and I think, unfortunately, a bit of the fantasy is to be able to deal with those, you know, other elements, whatever, however you see them, right?
Yeah. And you guys, you have any other?
The postman.
What's that all about?
The movie was crap compared to the book.
Oh really?
The book was really good. It was about a guy, post-nuclear, who was wandering about. You know, pretty organized guy, had a cart, you know, and had a bunch of stuff, you know. He's sitting around his camp, you
like
know.
Like a grocery cart?
Well, no, it was like something a little fancier even,
okay.
You know, moving about. Just
like a game cart.
Yeah, just gathering stuff and being, you know, by himself. He's attacked in his camp and escapes with his revolver and his camp shoes. He doesn't have anything, but he has to hide in this bramble over the side of the road, you know, while these guys take all the stuff he'd gathered. But he finds a mail jeep down there that had crashed with the postman still in it, you know. So there's this really nice postal service jacket and these mail bags. And so he's in there. He's hiding for a couple of days. It had rained or something like that, or he'd been injured. I can't remember, but he...
That actually sounds like a scene out of Lucifer's Hammer.
Well, he starts reading some of these letters, and he realizes they're nearby, and he's like, maybe I can get into the town that's nearby. You know, maybe some of these people are still there. So he takes these mail bags. And he shows up at the gate, you know, and all the guys are like, you know, who are you kind of thing.
I'm the mailman.
And he's like, well, is there a Grace whatever here, you know, and they're looking. So they bring this old woman out, and she's like, I'm Grace, you know, and then she opens the letter and reads it, you know, while they're all at the gate, you know, tense. And she's like, this is from my boy, you know, it finally got through, the mail got through, I can't believe you guys, you know.
That's
and so
interesting premise.
They bring him in and feed him and all this stuff, you know, and the farmer's daughter, so to speak, shows up, of course, you know. But then, within a few days, he's getting comfortable. They're like, well, we've got some letters for you for the next town. I guess you'll want to be moving along and doing, you know, he's like, and he gets kind of trapped into this thing, but he creates this mail service amongst these isolated communities, and kind of, it brings things back together.
He actually does become the mailman.
In a real sense, and in fact, some of the young men are really inspired by him, and they start this Pony Express, you know, and they're like, literally sacrificing their lives for the mail, and he feels like a fraud, you know. It's a really interesting book. The movie just made it into this weird kind of thing, but the book was amazing, actually. David Brin was the author of that.
And did you see the movie or the book?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
I fell asleep.
You fell asleep.
Kevin Costner is the lead in the movie.
Okay,
so that's
all right. Well,
yeah. And you know, it just shows the adaptability of the human. You know, where thrust into a certain situation, humans tend to rise to the occasion and wrap themselves into it and do what it needed to survive. So yes, you know, in a bad situation, would there be a die-off? Certainly. But you know, there's always that resilient individual that will make the best of what's provided to him and keep things going.
And I like the postman because it was very positive in that sense. You know, it was like, it was a story about, you know, things had gone bad, but, you know, it was a story about people coming back together in a positive sense. You know, I mean, there was bad guys and all that kind of stuff. There's obviously an adventure component, you know, but it was, you know, the simple joy of sending a letter to someone was something that, you know, almost brought the, you know, the country back together again. Yeah.
So he was an opportunistic fella. He really didn't care about it.
And that, not on purpose, in a sense.
Right.
You know, he was,
but he
just
fell
kind of
into it.
Everyone kind of channeled him into this, you know, because he kept getting these letters, and he, you know, would be like, oh, okay, I guess I'll take.
Well, initially it was purposeful in that, you know, he scavenged the uniform because he needed to be warm,
jacket, yeah.
And he used the letters as a means of getting into the town, so he did take advantage of it. But then, yeah, the situation was kind of thrust on him to keep things going.
Yeah, yeah.
But he rose to it, even though he's kind of forced to. You know, the reluctant hero.
Yeah, theme. Exactly. Yeah.
And he provided a valuable service that you know, actually helped society prosper and grow again. And you know, communication is absolutely critical to civilization. And he provided that. And sometimes, you know, all it takes is some hope. And that's, of anything he did, he provided hope.
Yeah, exactly. And it made, and it's like, it takes, I mean, you think of these communities as people in a sense, you know, it takes them from the lonely individual fighting against nature to realizing that there's other people we can work together, you know, and those communities did that, you know, which was really interesting.
It's one thing that we lose sight of, you know, when you look at the prepper community or the survival community, they're all about equipment. And, you know, they want to get the best equipment or, you know, the best food or the best water filter or whatever, and they stockpile it. And and that is the least important part of the survival equation.
A lot of people would be surprised to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's precisely what you and Sig were telling me yesterday, that you don't want a big medical kit, you want the knowledge.
Yes, yeah.
Not that a big medical kit doesn't help you.
Well, I mean,
you need the knowledge.
Having knowledge allows you to have a big kit of more effective things too, you know. I mean, a lot of this stuff is really just in case things that you'll never touch, but yeah.
So, you know, tools are your, and equipment and supplies are your least important thing. The next thing is skills, knowing how to use these things. That, you know, the tools don't do you any good if you have no concept of how to use them. And so I think, you know, the knowledge of how to use these things is much more important. But even more important, to bring us back to the postman and the hope thing, is spirit. Spirit is what gets us through tough situations. The heart to drive on, regardless of what's happening, I'm going to go on.
And you read real survival stories of people that survived harrowing circumstances. It's never prepared people. You know, it's a guy that doesn't even have a Swiss Army knife, but he wanted to get out of there alive and did, you know, and that's the only thing you need, in a sense, is the will to live. And then beyond that, you can make it happen if you have to.
Yeah, and that's probably the hardest thing to train, but yeah, when they study people that have survived bad situations, it's always spirit or their heart that has gotten them through it, and it, you know, it's not that it's the biggest person or the strongest person, it's the one that had the most drive to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it good to have, you know, equipment and mindset and the skills to use that? Absolutely, but they don't do you any good if you've lost your spirit. Your will to go on, you know, and you say, hey, why bother? I've got a basement full of food, but
when it runs out, what are you going to do?
Right. Or, and society's collapsing. I'm just demoralized, and you know, I put a bullet in my brain because I don't want to live this way. So what's, you know, what did those things do for you?
I think the people that just warehouse a lot of stuff and they're frightened of their neighbors, they're doing themselves a great disservice.
Well,
because
they're selecting against themselves in an end of the world scenario. You know, like the evolutionary pressures of those situations work against the individual who hoards, in a sense. You know, I mean, it's good to stockpile things, but, you know, you have to trust people eventually. What's the point of surviving otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
Which is brings me to Patriots.
Patriots. Okay.
That was a...
You guys all seen the Patriots?
No, it's a... It was
a book.
Oh,
a
book, okay.
Originally a web book, but now published.
Okay.
But this was your classic survival fiction where they have, you know, 100,000 rounds of ammunition and a compound in Idaho and all of that stuff. And it's kind of almost like a cartoon caricature of survivalism, you know? It's like...
What's the scenario in the Patriots?
I believe it's an
economic collapse.
Economic collapse,
okay,
yes.
And
familiar.
They were smart enough to, you know, kind of see it in advance. And a couple of the... it was a number of couples that had gotten together and were starting to prep. You know, they trained, they did commonality on weapons
and ammunition
you know, got vehicles that were EMP resistant and they really thought about it.
They did all this before this collapse occurred.
Yes.
Huh?
It's a bit of a checklist story in a sense, though. You know, it's like where the author sat down and thought, you know, if the world was going to end and I knew it, here's all the stuff I'd want, you know.
Unfortunately, we don't really know how those things play out, do we?
Yeah. No.
So, you know, you try to do your best guess.
And there's some bad caricatures in there, you know, like the first bad guys they end up executing are cannibals that have communist, like Mao's Little Red Book or something like
that's
that.
That's not a bad choice.
But I mean, really, you know, it's like...
That's right. Why Idaho?
Yeah.
It's like, can you sort of wear, you know, your heart on your sleeve more? You know?
Would you say so?
They always pick Idaho as the place they make the compound in. You know.
All the compounds are in Idaho.
Yeah, there's lots of potatoes there.
Right,
they're easy to store.
Right. So you know, at least the guy in the Postman, just from, I haven't read it, but
I highly recommend it. Yeah.
It sounds like he didn't choose that. So here he is in a situation. He had the attitude to survive. It isn't the life he chose. But he found the way to make it work, and it worked for other people, even though you might say he was a fraud.
Yeah, and he felt he was a fraud through the whole story.
Well, he was the reluctant hero,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Which is an archetype that, you know, we've had in literature and stories before literature, you know, probably forever, where, you know, I don't really want to do this, but, you know, you do what you have to do, even if you didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people play the game of all of this, but in a real-life situation, they fall short. So, I mean, at least guys who have been in the military or have done something like this, they realize that when you're under stress, you don't have the luxury to figure all this out. Sometimes it's just upon you all of a sudden. Like if you were in Tokyo, you didn't have time to plan for all of that.
No, and you're not in your rural property or whatever. I find the military an interesting thing because they these are people that the entire purpose is to have a group working together in an organized fashion. But a lot of these guys come home and are very individualistic in their survival plans. You know, it's kind of a strange paradox.
Yeah.
Now, I've actually lived through a pretty bad situation where it was a Cat 5 hurricane, and I live on an island in the
where
Caribbean.
Where was this said?
This was on St. Thomas in 1995. Hurricane Marilyn came through and severely damaged 80% of the buildings on the island, and there was absolute lawlessness for about 5 days before the federal agents could come in and you know, provide some protection.
What happened during those 5 days?
Well, it was very interesting. It was quite a learning experience because the looting started before the hurricane had fully passed.
Now, were people just stealing basic survival essentials like televisions?
Yes, absolutely. and you know,
diapers. Well, that's essential.
Yeah.
What you're going to find is how people react will be based on the demographics. The people that were used to living on the dole were the first ones to go out taking. The ones that were, you know, more self-reliant in that they had their own job and provided for themselves were more likely to, you know, continue to that trend. So you had, you know, small communities banding together, blocking off the entrance to their communities so that only, you know, hey, you don't live here, you don't come in because you obviously have bad intent. So, you know, immediately, even though there was no pre-planning, you know, one or two people would take charge and set up security and, you know, set up checkpoints, roadblocks, and you know, get volunteers to man that. You also saw that with people taking care of each other, you know. As soon as you were able to, you know, crawl out of the wreckage, you checked on your neighbor.
And so you really saw the best and the worst.
You saw absolutely the best and the worst. And this was, you know, most people hadn't prepared, so this was just ad hoc. And so
your biggest, what was the biggest issue aside from thieves? Was it like no water or no food or what?
Well, it was, that didn't play in because we're unique in that we, there's no groundwater, so the majority of people collect rainwater in cisterns.
Okay.
So water wasn't an issue. And I think that, you know, if you look at the average person who lives in a city or a subdivision, water is going to be their biggest problem because they're relying on a town supply, and that's going to go. And then what do you do? And you go through a lot of water. We don't recognize that. So if you're going to prepare, you need to figure out how are you going to drink? How are you going to wash? How are you going to flush your toilets? So water wasn't an issue. The federal government had C-130s landing within a few hours of as soon as the runway was clear. And so we had MREs coming in. FEMA, you know, had supplies. Now, it took the government 5 days to figure out how to distribute it. But you're not going to starve to death in 5 days.
Right. So really, food or water in your case wasn't the issue. Power was out, I'm presuming?
Power was out, but, you know, I live in a tropical environment, so nobody was freezing.
Okay.
And so The issue was there was no law enforcement whatsoever. The only law was that which you were willing and able to provide for yourself. So all of a sudden you saw people, you know, going around strapped. You know, they all had guns, you know, well, not everybody, but the ones that had guns went around openly carrying them,
right.
Which, you know, would have been, you know, not acceptable previously, but nobody said a thing about it for that week when there was no law. And there was opportunistic groups going around. Once the stores were looted, which took about 2 days, they went into the neighborhoods.
And you know, then things start to get serious.
So there you were huddled in the ruins of your house, and you've got, you know, a group of five or six people coming in and doing what they want to you. So, you know, robberies, rapes, not so much murders, but beatings. And so if you were not able to provide for your own security, then you were a victim. So
with that in mind, what would you, I mean, that was a real life experience. What would you suggest to people in average neighborhoods in the United States to deal with that possibility? Neighborhood watches or what?
Absolutely.
Be neighbors.
You know, I mean, that's a missing ingredient in a sense. You know, we all live in our houses, and a lot of times we don't even know our neighbors. But if we go to the door with a plate of cookies when someone moves in and actually give of ourselves a little bit, then we have a neighborhood in a real sense.
Yeah.
That's an easy thing to mobilize in a disaster. It's harder when, you know, shit, the town's on fire, I got to introduce myself to everyone here.
That's
you know,
a difficult time
to
do.
No credibility or any of that.
Now, that will happen somewhat naturally. I met neighbors that I didn't know when, you know,
course,
I had my chainsaw out and I was cutting my way out to the road so we can get out, and, you know, people would see me out there and they'd come out and start hauling wood off the side of the road that I was cutting. But it shouldn't have happened. It should have been.
Makes it possible.
Right.
Yeah.
But it should have happened beforehand. So you may not be able to get your group together and say, you know, all right, we should, you know, everybody should have, you know, 2 weeks of food in the house. People probably won't buy into that. But if just if you have the framework.
And why won't people buy into that? Money? Monetary?
No,
don't
I think
see
it's
the need for it. I think a lot of people don't understand why you would do that. You know?
I see. I always thought most people that I've talked to thought it was a great idea, but just didn't want to bother actually taking the time to do it, or they put it off.
Humans are lazy.
Yeah.
And you probably see a little bit more of the positive side because of where you live. You know, earthquakes are definitely a threat, a very possible threat. So people are more likely to have a little bit of, you know, water and food for at least, you know, 3 days or a week.
Unfortunately, that's become a bit more fashionable these days for whatever reason. You know, survival is kind of big again for a while. You know?
Well, absolutely. If you look at the demographic here at Dirt Time, I mean, you saw the suburban housewife that was here, you know, and who was worried about a collapse. You know, not just nature causing problems, but, you know, we're teetering on the brink economically. You know, will it tip over? I don't know. I'm not an economist, but we're certainly...
You're not an economist, but you deal with money every day. So we all have to deal with it, right?
I keep it safe, yes. But it's prudent to be able to take care of yourself. So I think your first step is being able to take care of yourself. Your second step is increasing the circle out to the next level of knowing your neighbors, and a crime watch is a good place to start if, you know, crime is an issue. And because then you have some sort of framework to work on. So, you know, and then you can start, you know, gently nudging these people, saying, you know, hey, you know, if something happens, you know, do you have a little bit of food at home? You know, maybe you want to check out www.ready.gov because they talk about, you know, having a 3-day kit. And this is from the government, so it must be okay, right? And
Culp. but we're all kind of agreeing that the you get a lot of good ideas from the survival literature, and one of the best practical ways for the average person to take some action is to get to know your neighbors, start Neighborhood Watch. How many of you guys have Neighborhood Watch? Anybody here? Do you have a neighborhood? Tell us about your Neighborhood Watch, Sig. And you do too, Anna. I want to hear about it.
I see the signs. I don't really know the people.
You see the signs,
yeah,
but
I see the signs all over.
So this is Neighborhood
there
Watch.
There is something, since you brought this topic, brings back a curiosity I have about all these books and movies. They have cannibalism.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
let's
I'm wondering.
Branch out into zombies. It's still people eating people.
I wonder how real is this as an issue? Like, how
How could it be,
but
you know?
It gives you the ultimate excuse to kill them if they're eating people, you know what I mean?
It brings a whole new meaning to the word neighborhood watch.
Or to serve man.
Keep an eye on your neighbor.
Lucifer's hammer's cannibalism was intimidation. They weren't really eating bodies.
It was like cultural.
Yeah, it was to cause fear of that particular group.
Yeah.
But I think that would be pretty bad if we have to start. I mean, Sig would be good to eat, but you're kind of bony.
I know.
What about your neighborhood watch, Anna?
The one on our block is actually just in its infancy. We've just started joining up for meetings. So far, it's mostly comprised of single mothers and housewives.
Yeah, and does Jose go to the meetings too?
Yeah, it's usually the lone...
Is he a single mother or a housewife?
The lone sausage.
Well, I'm both.
So what do you guys... besides just getting to know each other, what do you guys do at your meetings?
And right now, trying to expand our area of influence, get more of our neighbors involved, and trying to get a better lines of communication with our local law enforcement.
Yeah.
So that's what... So like I said, it's really in its infancy. We're just barely getting started. In fact, we missed a meeting to be here.
Well, when I did Neighborhood Watch in my neighborhood, there was a lot of crime and burglaries and break-ins, and the first thing we did is just make sure everybody had each other's phone number and knew who lived where, and there was a lot of resistance, but there was no crime.
See, our neighbor where I live is very rural, you know, and there's a house maybe every quarter mile, you know, and a lot of people live on 50 acres or 20 acres or 10 acres, but I mean, everyone just kind of helps each other out. We don't have a neighborhood watch, in a sense. You know,
anyone. Old-fashioned neighborhood watch.
Yeah, exactly. You just kind of know what's going on, and you know, you're friendly. You give them eggs. They, you know, they'll cut a tree for you. You know, neighborly behavior.
Well, that goes
creates
back to
a peaceful society. Yeah.
Yeah, that goes back to the demographics. If you live in small town America, you know, they tend to be more self-reliant and they watch out for each other, and that's good and bad. I mean, I grew up in a town of 2,500, and you couldn't do anything without everybody knowing. So there's, you know, the positive aspects and the bad aspects of that. So, you know, if it's a localized small situation and you live in a rural community, you're probably going to be okay. You're probably not going to have to deal with this lawless issue. Now, if it turns into a longer period thing where, you know, so what's going to happen if there's no food? You know, people are going to go with what's closest to them. Eventually, that will wear out, run out.
That's Vons and Ralphs of the neighborhood.
Exactly. And, you know, so how long does that week last? You know, a couple of weeks, a month, and then they're going to have to start, you know, moving out like locusts.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you may be okay right now, but if it's a long-term situation, then, you know, you need to be prepared for, you know, the hordes, you know, the people that are going to come out and raid. And I think the chances of that are fairly low because it would have to be a very major problem, you know, for that to happen. You know, supplies would have to be totally cut off for long periods of time. So when I'm talking to people about getting ready, I tell them that, you know, there's a good chance, a really good chance that something's going to happen to you localized, and you should be able to stay at home for 1 to 2 weeks.
1 to 2 weeks, okay.
And that's easy to prepare for. And then, you know, if you want to, you can push out from there, you know, go out to a month, go out to 2-3 months, and get stuff that you use. And, you know, then you have to decide, you know, what are the chances of something really serious happening, you know, where total societal collapse, whether it's, you know, man-made or nature. You know, the chances of that happening, I think, are a lot more slender. So, you know, at that point, you have to decide whether you want to continue prepping for that.
Right. So
the other thing about prepping, there's a positive angle to it. I mean, you're making yourself self-reliant, but a lot of times, you know, you can prep in order to be less of a burden to other people when they can't afford it, you know, and to be able to help other people when they need it.
Right.
Yeah. That, once again, going back to my situation after Hurricane Marilyn, you know, FEMA was starting to distribute stuff about 5 days after the event, and I didn't need to stand in those lines.
FEMA down in your island.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I was able to stay home, and I didn't have to expose myself to standing in long lines in the sun. I didn't have to expose myself to, you know, wandering around and potentially getting, you know, victimized because I'm in, you know, I'm a target as I'm moving around.
Someone else, I mean, he allowed someone else to be one person ahead in that line.
Yes.
Just by being ready for himself.
Yes.
You know, it's like a double benefit.
I was not a burden.
Yeah,
I was safer. And
in fact, the opposite. You're a positive, you know, I mean, someone else got to get their food quicker because he was ready.
Right,
know?
He didn't have to be in that line.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in that
ready,
line.
If that would be great, but that's, life doesn't work that way.
Hey, did anybody here ever see the movie called Zardoz?
Yes, with
Sean
Connery.
Yeah. Anybody else see that? You saw that? Anybody see that movie?
No.
So that was, something happened to society, and you had the insiders and the outsiders.
Right.
Outsiders. And it's actually a really good, there's a lot of interesting lessons in there. You had these elites. They had everything. And then you had all the people outside who were just getting shot.
That was a big theme, too, because Logan's Run was very much like
Logan's
that.
Logan's Run.
That was a very insular community where they would kill anyone over a certain age.
Were they the ones that lived
age.
Underground?
Underground, right.
And
but when they went outside, you know, there's still people living out there.
Right. Well, okay, we got about 2.5 minutes left for today. And any of you guys want to share any particular points or movies or novels or things that you want to leave with our listeners today?
We covered a lot there.
We covered about everything. We should just shut down now.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably some great ones out there that we've forgotten.
Somebody wrote down Hunger Games. I've never read that. I've heard of that. Have you heard of Hunger Games or read it?
I've read Hunger Games. It's by Susan Collins, and it was a very. I'm going to try to put all this in an organized fashion, but it's basically about after a nuclear fallout of the world. It's based in the United States. And it's about, they have a capital, like their government is based on a capital in 13 districts. The 13 districts are all specialized, like they have a coal district, and they have a textile district, they have an electronic district.
This is North America?
Yeah, this is North America. And the capital keeps all these districts isolated from each other, so it keeps them completely dependent on
the capital.
I mean, there's only one form of transportation between all the districts, and
what's
I mean,
that form of transportation?
Just like a speed train.
I see. Interesting.
That's interesting.
And it's I mean, you have these super beings that are the police force and things like that, that the enforcers and things, and so I mean, all these people, every year the Capitol puts on these Hunger Games, and it's like an appreciation for the Capitol, which keeps them even more oppressed, which is they give their two children from every district have to go and they have to participate in these Hunger Games.
And what is a Hunger Game?
A Hunger Game is kind of like they create these whole terrains in these arenas, and they have to go in and they have a centralized place where they have weapons, basic weapons, knives, spears. I mean, since all these districts specialize they're specialized in the sea, so they have tridents, they have, the hunter and gatherers where they got bows and arrows and things like that, and these kids have to fight to the death, basically.
Fight to the death, like this is the Roman barbarian days
exactly,
all over again.
Exactly, and it's a way to keep all these districts oppressed, and so, I mean, the book is basically about Katniss Everdeen. She's the survivor, and I mean, she goes through, and they're in these games, and I mean, after the games are over, of course she wins, but I mean, after these games are over, they start getting this rebellion. The 13th district was a nuclear district, and they tried to rebel against the Capitol, and they basically fell off the grid. And so they fell off the grid and became very self-sufficient, and they have been, getting supplies and getting power and things like that. And so now, towards the end of the Hunger Games, they stage this whole thing where they're going to rebel, and they're going to get every district to go against the Capitol.
Let me ask you, what did you glean from those books that would have some practical application to you today?
I just like you guys were talking about in the other novels, the real thing is humanity, and you have to be able to rely on other people and to have a sense of unity. Because without that, you're not going to survive. In any survival situation, you can't do it by yourself, and you have to be able to work together and pool your resources and survive, basically.
Cool, and that's our time for today. This is Dirt Time 2012. Hey, dude, I didn't see you back there. Say hello.
Yeah, I'm just hiding.
Okay. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.